From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Thursday night, something unusual happened.
Governor Kasich, you're one of two remaining sitting governors still in the race. Your colleague, Governor Rick Snyder in Michigan, is under fire, he and his administration, for the Flint, Michigan water crisis and the botched response to it. How would you have handled that?
As an African-American living near Ferguson, I've seen the strain between police officers and the communities they serve firsthand. Why aren't we using the technology available to better protect our communities?
Senator Rubio, on the issue of climate change, in 2008, you wanted Florida to get ahead of other states and establish a cap-and-trade system. Now you're a skeptic of climate change science, so why the change?
An actual debate with, you know, questions about issues. And not only that, but the moderators even acknowledged that the candidates had held different positions in the past, and they provided evidence, such as when Megyn Kelly played a video montage of Senator Marco Rubio making contradictory statements about the path to citizenship.
Within 2 years of getting elected, you were co-sponsoring legislation to create a path to citizenship. In your words, amnesty. Haven't you already proven that you cannot be trusted on this issue?
No, because if you look at the quote, and it's very specific, and it says blanket amnesty. I do not support blanket amnesty.
But you went on from
I do not support amnesty.
You said more than that, sir.
No, I said I do not support blanket
legalization. You said earned path to citizenship is basically code for amnesty. You supported earned path to citizenship.
Of course, it's one thing to have substantive questions, quite another to receive substantive answers. For instance, here's moderator Chris Wallace asking Governor Chris Christie about his position on Kim Davis, the Kentucky county clerk who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples.
Governor Christie, you said that she must follow the law or be moved to another job that would be in keeping with her conscience. But some conservatives say that that violates her religious liberty.
Christie's answer?
Here's the problem with what's going on around the world. The radical Islamic jihadists, what they want to do is impose their faith upon each and every one of us. Every one of us. That's why, as commander-in-chief, I will take on ISIS, not only because it keeps us safe, but because it allows us to absolutely conduct our religious affairs the way we find in our heart and in our souls.
Later, YouTube personality Dulce Candy posed a question to Ben Carson about immigration.
If America does not seem like a welcoming place for immigrant entrepreneurs, will the American economy suffer?
Dr. Carson?
That's one of the reasons that I have called on us to declare war on the Islamic State, because we need to reorient our immigration policies and our visa policies for people who are coming into this country, because there are many people out there who want to destroy us.
And Marco Rubio's response to that aforementioned challenge on the path to citizenship? Duh.
Number one, we're going to keep ISIS out of America. If we don't know who you are or why you're coming, you will not get into the United States.
If changing the subject is the tactical lifeblood of live debate, ISIS was the O negative, the universal donor. Of course, there was something else different about this evening, what moderator Megyn Kelly called the GOP elephant not in the room. You know, that rich loudmouth with all the insults. What's his name? Senator Cruz?
Now, secondly, let me say, I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
Oh, right. Donald Duck the question, who decided to boycott the debate because of what he calls bias on the part of Megyn Kelly and what others might call moderating or seeking accountability or journalism. But if Trump was absent from the debate stage, he was front and center in the hearts and minds of many newscasters. Here's MSNBC's Morning Joe team.
And we turned on the TV, and I'm glad I did. It was Trump's plane landing in Des Moines. And I swear to God,
it was
like the Pope had landed with,
probably a nicer plane,
with the Middle East Peace Pact to end 3,000 years of war. The grand spectacle of it all was every bit as remarkable as the story Heilman told in Iowa with Trump. Yeah, and he planned it.
He planned it. We filmed it. Same as it ever was.
If the Beltway pundits were shocked at the audacity of Trump's debate snub, commentators outside the mainstream saw it coming a mile away.
I've heard people on Fox last night talk about this. Who does he think he is? He can't control the media. I got news for you. He is controlling the media.
Talk radio guru Rush Limbaugh.
He controls the media when he's not on it. He controls the media when he is on it. He controls the media when he's asleep. Nobody else has been able to do anything like this short of the Kennedys and their pikers compared to the way Trump is doing this.
No, says Limbaugh, this is not an endorsement. But to any of you who may have heard rumors of talk radio's decline, all I can say is not this primary season. This truly is conservative talk radio's election. Michael Harrison of Talkers Magazine says talk show hosts praise God for giving them Trump. Trump is, quote, a shock jock now running for president. Meanwhile, Ted Cruz, running second, has made talk radio the centerpiece of his strategy. So now that medium has two native sons battling it out and bumping up the ratings. Matt Katz, a political reporter for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio, is an avid listener to talk radio, by which I mean, of course, conservative talk radio. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, Brooke.
So first, has conservative talk radio taken a side? Trump or Cruz?
They are mostly playing it coy, led by Rush Limbaugh, who will sometimes have mild critiques of one or the other, and his criticism is read very carefully, like tea leaves, to see what he really means. Glenn Beck has taken a side. He has officially endorsed Ted Cruz. It's very interesting to see that, unlike previous elections, talk radio has two guys that are sort of personify their ideal Republican candidate.
Can you tell who's more popular?
It started with Cruz. He's like the natural outgrowth of conservative talk. But Trump is starting to supplant Cruz, and not because of ideological reasons. He has more pizzazz than Cruz. Trump has this cross-cultural appeal. It's not all angry old white men who like him. And that's what I'm told is consistent with the listenership of talk radio. It's a little bit more diverse than you might expect.
Why is Ted Cruz putting talk radio at the center of his strategy?
He has risen through the ranks by using talk radio. I mean, his campaign chairman recently said that the reach of talk radio is greater than any other medium. It's an anti-establishment campaign, and talk radio is based on this idea that the vast majority of elected Republicans in this country have laid down and let themselves get trampled on by President Obama, whereas Ted Cruz has acted as a senator in the way that talk radio listeners have always called for their elected officials to act.
Cruz's campaign chairman said the reach of talk radio is greater than every other medium. I guess it's possible. Radio signals blanket the country even more thoroughly than TV signals, but does it have greater audience than, say, television?
It's hard to get a sense of the numbers. What we do know, though, is the influence of talk radio is evident in places like Breitbart, the hard-right conservative website that has been very important to Trump's rise. And their content really echoes what you've heard on talk radio for the last, you know, couple of decades. I mean, the role of it in the larger communication apparatus of conservatives is really the way to evaluate its influence, I think. They represent the grassroots, whatever that might mean.
Is that another way of saying the base, which is another way of saying the most extreme?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I mean, it's hard to understand until you listen how much these people can't stand their elected Republicans. They believe their elected officials have for too long neglected their voices.
And within that context, I guess, the kind of things that are acceptable to say on talk radio, well, there's really nothing you can't say.
Yeah, it seems that way sometimes. For example, recently, Ted Cruz's wife, Heidi, was on 1400 AM KVFD in Iowa, and she was asked about the fact that her husband was born in Canada, but the way the host put the question, it was quite unique.
So, Mrs. Cruz, Heidi Cruz, would you please respond to the fact of whether you're sleeping with an immigrant?
This is the age-old question, but What do you think came first? Did talk radio create these opinions among the conservative base, or are the hosts just a reflection of it?
I imagine it's a little bit of both. I think where the talk show hosts really lead is in their story selection. There are like a half a dozen topics that they are constantly harping on. I mean, Benghazi has an outsized role in their conversations. The bias in the mainstream media, political correctness is huge, huge. You notice how I said huge because that's what Donald Trump talks about constantly.
And of course, feminism is a great target there, right? I mean, didn't Rush Limbaugh come up with the phrase feminazi?
I believe he did come up with that. That seems like a phrase of the 90s, doesn't it? But these are still very current concerns on conservative talk. Rush Limbaugh continues to talk about the idea that Democrats and liberals use minorities and women as a card to play against Republicans.
And Trump, of course, talking about how, hey, you know, you got to be careful, Hillary. You send him out there, you better not be start playing your vagina card. But she's playing that card.
Jeb Bush recently said this about Hillary, that she's great at being the victim. And that is a line of argument that Rush has been pushing for a quarter century. They're also preoccupied with race. But in talking about race, they always talk about how the other side is preoccupied with race.
They'll say they're called racists, but their Islamophobia knows no bounds. It doesn't seem to cause a ripple when candidate Mike Huckabee, who used to be a show host, had a guest saying this.
Islam, I do believe, is an inherently evil and soul-destroying, freedom-destroying force in the earth.
And then Laura Ingraham, more recently.
Maybe we don't have video of the thousands of people on the rooftop, but is that really the point here? Yeah, you be as accurate as you can, clearly. But to listen to the media criticism of Trump, there was nobody. Every Muslim in the United States was celebrating, united against terrorism.
Some of these conversations, they're talking about one thing, but they're really talking about another. So Laura Ingraham is talking about Trump's now famous allegation that Muslims in New Jersey celebrated September 11th, 2001. But in defending Trump, what she was really doing was blasting the media criticism of Trump for the statement. So she's not confirming what Trump said, but she is just pointing out that the mainstream media is constantly trying to label their side as racist or intolerant.
And it doesn't matter that Trump libeled an entire ethnic group? That doesn't matter?
That would be seen as unreasonable sensitivity. The concern here is that mainstream media is poisoning America against certain people on the right.
One of the things I find particularly interesting about talk radio in particular is it talks about how very popular it is, how it really represents the people outside the corridors of power. This is a populist majority that only gets to speak through this particular microphone.
Absolutely. There's this idea that that's why anti-establishment candidates are doing so well right now in the primary, because that idea resonates. Rush is right when he says this.
You know, talk radio, it's a euphemism. Talk radio means the base of the party. Talk radio means the grassroots. Talk radio means Tea Party, what have you.
It is not just a medium. Talk radio represents an ideology.
So if we want to know what's going on in the heads of conservatives in Iowa, listen to local talk radio there?
Absolutely. You know, people were confounded that Dr. Ben Carson was doing so well earlier this year in the polls. They wouldn't have been confounded if they had been listening to talk radio. Polls indicate that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump will, in Iowa, finish in first or second place. And it is no surprise that they are the two most popular candidates on conservative talk. And if Donald Trump becomes the president, we will have a talk radio host as the president of the United States. Isn't that exciting?
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Matt Katz is a political reporter for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio and a frequent contributor to the podcast, The Christie Tracker. He's also the author of the new book, American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption.
Trump is simply following the lead of your host, Rush Limbaugh, blustering braggadocio, gleeful political incorrectness, and of course, prized rudeness.
Coming up, why a credit score for radicalization is probably impossible.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Earlier this month, a delegation of top U.S. government officials, including FBI Director James Comey and Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson, met with executives of Apple, Twitter, Facebook, and other tech companies to discuss battling terrorism online. One idea was an algorithm that could crawl social sites for signs of radicalization and assign people a risk value like a credit score. The government would then, in theory, use that information to monitor the riskiest subjects. But is that legal? Karen Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. Karen, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just say that the tech companies were able to put together some sort of algorithm that was actually quite good at crawling only the public spaces of the social web and somehow able to see the juxtaposition of certain words, whether it's jihad or explosives or broccoli, that gives a pretty good profile of intent to commit a terrorist act, let's just say. And some Joe Blow triggers the radicalization monitor. What could the companies and the government do with that high credit score legally?
That's a very good question. And this is related to issues that have been under debate legally ever since the Snowden revelations, if not before that. And so you're going to get a range of legal opinions on what they can collect. But the real question is here is what can they collect with a warrant and what can they collect without a warrant? And what they would have to do is show probable cause for some kind of criminal activity. If it were about foreign intelligence, it would be another kind of warrant. And then they could pursue some kind of investigation. Now, this is what goes on now when the FBI is trying to figure out who might be at risk of some kind of violent act.
It's really hard to imagine any sort of algorithmically generated score being useful in court to show the intention to commit a crime. But I can certainly see an FBI agent going to a judge and saying, look, you know, we've got this guy's scores. There's a high probability that he's very sympathetic to ISIS and the chatter is alarming. A judge saying, okay, you know, you may surveil him. You can have a warrant for that. How scrupulous do you think the judiciary will be in the face of what looks like a scientifically derived value?
I'm going to be an optimist about it. There's going to be a great deal of scrutiny about such a system. And let me say something about the courts and how they've dealt with individuals attracted to ISIS, which is somewhat different than how they've reacted to people accused of being associated with Al-Qaeda. There has been a sense that these are troubled youth, that they are often loners, that they are people who want to be terrorists but don't have the wherewithal, the means, the maturity. And I think that judges will take all of this into account and deal with it very carefully. with a sense of rehabilitation rather than using the criminal justice system as a hammer. I do think that the idea that there could be some kind of radicalization tendency score is really anathema to how we think about criminal justice, probable cause, innocent until proven guilty. And I think that's going to come up time and again in suits, and that judges will be receptive and open to that.
When I first read this story, I said to myself, Bob, I said, this doesn't sound like just a pipe dream of security hawks. It sounds to me like something the government's probably doing right now. Call me paranoid, but seems to me this is happening already.
Well, I'm not going to say that you're paranoid. I think there are reasons to be watchful and vigilant. I think the government in the past has been excessive in its use of surveillance authorities that many would argue it didn't legally have. But I think particularly in the wake of the Patriot Act's demise of Section 215 and the metadata program being declared illegal, privacy concerns are spread across different constituencies in the United States. The one thing we have learned from this conversation with Silicon Valley and this idea of algorithms is that national security officials are not going to back down that easily from having powers such as that were conveyed by Section 215 of the Patriot Act taken away from them. But it's a robust debate, and it's not going to go down that easily.
I understand that the tech companies have historically been loath to hand over some of the data that the government has requested. However, they were at this powwow, and for whatever reason, maybe it's a patriotic duty, maybe it's a security duty, they seem to be on board with this.
I agree with you. The way this was reported in the media, it made it seem like the technology companies were very interesting in providing the service to the government. You can be sure that there is going to be a tremendous amount of pushback and challenge to any policy that's developed along these lines, whether it's transparent or secretive. But I want to underscore the idea that these algorithms could actually perform the kind of service that really needs to be performed by individuals with judgment, who have relationships with people. This is going to be a distraction when really what needs to be done is focused, interpersonal, reality-based understanding of what motivates people to take violent acts in the name of some kind of radical ideology.
Karen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Karen Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. John Horgan is a professor of global studies and psychology at Georgia State University, where he studies terrorist behavior. He says that based on what we know about radicalization, the notion of a terrorist spotting algorithm is, quote, doomed to failure.
The simple reason is that radicalization is such a complex process. We really haven't developed the scientific basis for the kinds of questions that people are looking to answer right now. If there's one conclusion that has emerged from about 40 years of research, is it's a story of diversity. We have lots of different people becoming involved in terrorism in lots of different kinds of ways.
You could probably say the same of those who are very bad at paying their bills or who are pedophiles. And yet there is similar software out there scouring the web for signs of creditworthiness and so forth. Is that kind of technology not applicable to a radicalization detector?
Pedophilia and terrorism are quite different. I mean, there is no clear sense of what involvement in terrorism is. Terrorism can involve everything from browsing radical sites to donating money to questionable charities, to the far more extreme activity of wanting to go overseas to become a foreign fighter or constructing bombs. But the idea that we can somehow reduce all of this to something that can easily be measured, if not detected, is unusual to me.
We don't have the so-called semantic web yet, computers that actually understand language. But we do have a fairly evolved industry based on what's called sentiment analysis, which is used by companies to things as mundane as tracking their popularity of their brands online. cannot such systems also at least begin to track radical sentiment?
It can certainly track radical sentiment, and it can possibly be used to track people who have an interest in exploring radical sentiment, but that will in no reliable way allow you to predict who is likely to become involved in terrorism. There is nothing wrong with being a radical. There's nothing wrong with holding radical views and in some cases expressing radical views, however inappropriate they might seem to you or me or anybody else. Research tells us that there are far more people who hold and who will profess radical views than will ever seek to become involved in terrorism. There are a lot of people who, for example, would classify themselves as ISIS supporters, and the beginning and the end of their involvement lies completely and exclusively online. That is all that they do. There is no desire for them to necessarily go and engage in real-world activity. And to further confuse matters, there is increasing evidence to suggest that people who become involved in terrorism don't necessarily hold radical views, at least not to begin with. In many cases, we see people's radical views developing as a result of spending time in a terrorist group.
If there is a typical terrorist, is it someone who seethes for years or decades and then finally is moved to act? Or is it more often somebody who is just particularly predisposed to violence who gloms on to some sort of radical philosophy, perhaps at the last minute, in order to make his mark on the world?
It's all of that and more, Bob. I've interviewed members of Al-Qaeda, members of the IRA in Northern Ireland. I've interviewed young kids in Pakistan. Even within specific groups, there are multiple different pathways. Some become involved because they're motivated by the excitement, the glamour, the adventure, the romanticized notion they have. Others get involved simply because they're at the wrong place at the wrong time, and a family member is involved, a friend or a group of friends, and they simply find themselves going along. There are lots of examples of individuals I've interviewed who have said, well, I didn't realize why I became involved in this movement until, for example, I wound up in prison.
What should the United States government, with or without Silicon Valley's assistance, be focusing on to identify potential terrorists online?
Basic research to answer these common questions. I think we're all sick and tired of hearing academics such as myself saying, well, look, we don't know, there's no profile, and here is the diversity, but we don't really know what to do with it. We really need to start moving beyond that to be able to give firmer answers. But in the absence of funded research that is facilitated by access to better information, we're forever going to be in the dark here. I applaud the fact that the government is exploring these public-private partnerships, but the research community seems to be absent from these discussions, and that is worrying, to say the least.
I know you would like to see actual research into the psychology of terrorism, but I wonder if there's anything in these vast data troves of Facebook and Twitter and so forth that does interest you as a scientist and you think may have some value, if not for the creation of a terrorism detector.
Oh, I think there's extraordinary value. I mean, the reason why so many would-be jihadists and in many cases simply jihadist supporters are so deeply embedded in with their online world is because it has deep psychological and cultural meaning to them. We need to understand far more about what are the specific qualities of that material. Is it for personal consumption? Do they share it? I know that most people would make a fairly plausible assumption that if you look at this material, if you spend time with it, then that somehow puts you at greater risk for becoming involved in terrorism. I don't buy that. It's an assumption. It's not something that is borne out by real life experience in many cases.
It's as if I spent my days playing Grand Theft Auto and police started targeting me because they think I'm a risk for creating mayhem and shooting civilians and police with automatic weapons.
Well, precisely, and that's a wonderful analogy. One of our researchers, Charlie Winter, discovered several senior female jihadis based in Syria complain to foreign supporters here in the United States to say to them, how dare you spend all of your time just engaging in social media? You need to get up off your backsides and come out here and join the fight. So when even ISIS themselves acknowledge that so many of their supporters begin and end their involvement online, then we know that we really need to proceed very, very carefully here if we think that we're somehow detecting terrorists.
John, many, many thanks.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
John Horgan is a professor of global studies and psychology at Georgia State University.
Coming up, the tangled, tantalizing web of free speech issues in the tug of war between the Center for Medical Progress and Planned Parenthood.
It has everything. It has a highly charged political issue. It has a righteous group of advocates who are out to right a wrong and will use any means to do that. You've got an organization that provides services. Are they culpable or are they being smeared? And what does all of this have to do with the public right to know?
This is On the Media.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, some news out of Texas that can really only be described one way.
A twist in the continuing story of an anti-abortion activist and his group, the Center for Medical Progress, and their undercover videos claiming to expose illegal activity by Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood was cleared of any wrongdoing by that grand jury in Texas. But there's a twist.
In a twist, the grand jury decided instead to indict two of the anti-abortion activists who were involved with making the videos.
The activists had claimed to be employees of biomedical firms and secretly filmed meetings with Planned Parenthood representatives in which they discussed fetal tissue transfers from abortions. David DeLeiden, the director of the Center for Medical Progress, says the covert videos, which he began posting in July, showed that Planned Parenthood was trying to profit from the fetal tissue donations. In August, the Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, an abortion opponent, asked a district attorney in Harris County to look into one of the videos that had been filmed there to see if there'd been any wrongdoing. The grand jury indicted DeLeiden and another activist on a felony charge of tampering with a government record, a fake driver's license apparently, which could carry a sentence of 2 to 20 years, plus a misdemeanor charge of attempting to buy human tissue filed against DeLeiden. Harris County DA Devin Anderson announced the indictments this week.
I believe abortion is wrong, but my personal belief does not relieve me of my obligation to follow the law. 12 Harris County citizens have spoken, and I respect their decision, even if it conflicts with my personal beliefs.
All along, DeLeiden has claimed the videos should be protected as works of journalism.
And really, it's just kind of a cheap political tactic for Planned Parenthood to try to describe any and all undercover journalism as unethical. I think that most people agree that that those kind of tactics are an important part of both journalism and law enforcement.
Trying to procure body parts, I think, is something that would not typically be something that journalists would do.
Jane Kirtley is professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. DeLeiden's claim, she says, taps into an unease about undercover work and could have a real impact on media law.
There was a belief, and I would argue still is a belief in the media community, that the role of a journalist is to gather the news, not to create the news, and certainly not to entrap people into committing illegal acts.
Really, people are of two minds, going back to the famous Food Lion case. Refresh our memories about the particulars.
Back in the 1990s, ABC had gotten a tip that there were problems with food safety at Food Lion grocery stores. So they sent in a couple of producers who applied for jobs so that they would be able to observe meat wrapping and other food handling practices.
And it was gross.
They take that pork that's already starting to get a slime to it, green tinge to it,
and they take and put that in the grinder with sausage mixture as fresh homemade sausage. And it's rotten.
They went in with hidden cameras, hidden microphones. They videotaped what they saw. They recorded some of the other employees. And when they went to do the story, Food Lion did not sue them for defamation, but they did sue them for a whole variety of what we often call trash torts, such as trespass, aiding and abetting, basically defrauding the employer. When journalists deceive to get a story, there are going to be consequences. If they're lucky, I suppose, the only consequence will be that their readers or viewers may find the deceptive reporting techniques so offensive that they discount the story. Otherwise, of course, they could actually have legal ramifications.
David DeLeiden, who is the director of the Center for Medical Progress, said that he was using the same undercover techniques that investigative journalists have been using for decades. But being a journalist, it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card, and he seems to think it is.
That's right. And there are journalists out there who are operating under the same illusion. The courts have said that laws that apply to everybody apply to the press just the same, except in very limited circumstances where you're able to show that the story you're doing is so important and could not be gotten any other way that it might justify allowing the journalist to get away with it. You can count those cases on the fingers of one hand.
Those circumstances have to do with the public interest, right?
Yes.
Give me an example or two of when the courts have decided that we'll give this journalist a pass on breaking the law because he has done so much in the public interest.
Well, one example from about 12 years ago, I guess, involves a case called Bartnicki versus Vopper that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. In this case, a telephone conversation between two teachers' unions activists had been surreptitiously intercepted. This tape found its way to a radio talk show host. He had not done anything to elicit the tape himself. People who were on the telephone conversation brought a civil lawsuit against him claiming violation of the federal wiretap law, which prohibits not only interception but dissemination of intercepted telephone conversations. The activists had been making threats, is what it was. It sounded like they were making threats, although they claimed it was all hyperbole. But because they were on the face of it, making threats, the Supreme Court said, because the journalist did nothing to record the conversation himself, and because this was a matter of public interest and concern, this was not something for which the journalist could be held liable. But there are many other examples where that hasn't been the case.
This Harris County grand jury in Texas found no wrongdoing on the part of Planned Parenthood. Actually, I think it's been 11 states that have looked into Planned Parenthood and found no wrongdoing so far.
Right. So the argument that I'm exposing criminal conduct doesn't take you very far if every state that has looked at it so far has concluded that there was no criminal conduct.
What if it was determined that Planned Parenthood had broken the law? Do you think that the Center for Medical Progress would still be indicted?
I don't know the answer to that question, and I think it's an important one because looking ahead, it's fair to ask ourselves whether the courts are going to be making these determinations based on what's ultimately a pretty subjective evaluation of whether wrongdoing has occurred, whether public health and safety are involved, and so forth. You know, do two wrongs make a right? Is surreptitious recording, for example, justified if what you're exposing is criminal misconduct? That's a perpetual kind of conundrum that courts have to try to balance.
Let's talk about prior restraint. A biotech firm called Stem Express, that's the broker which buys the human tissue samples and then resells them to researchers. That was also filmed by the Center for Medical Progress. It wanted to quash the center's tape because they said it would cause irreparable harm. One California court agreed with Stem Express that there should be prior restraint, and then another court overturned that. Your former organization, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, sided with the Center for Medical Progress, saying that they were concerned about the potential chilling effect. What do you think?
I agree.
The Supreme Court and other courts have said repeatedly, if the damage that's going to result is damage that could be compensated with money, then it's not irreparable harm. Whatever harm is caused to you can be compensated by bringing a lawsuit after the fact. On the other hand, if you restrain the distribution of this information, that causes irreparable harm to the First Amendment interests of the public who have a right to receive this information. Therefore, the irreparable harm is on the side of public knowledge, not on the private interests of a company.
But what about the argument that Planned Parenthood and the doctors that provide abortions are at risk because it increases the rage and sends the crazies into the street?
What they're basically arguing, I think, is an incitement theory. And one of the things that the Supreme Court has said many times about incitement is that this falls into only a very limited amount of speech, because people say incendiary things all the time. And if we were going to be allowed to gag them because somebody somewhere might decide to take a criminal action in response to it, we wouldn't have much discourse left.
Are you familiar with the action that Planned Parenthood is taking against the Center for Medical Progress? It seems to have wrapped up all its complaints into a single lawsuit based on the RICO Act, which is the Federal Racketeering and Corrupt Organization Act.
That's exactly right. And it also includes a violation of the California state wiretap and surreptitious reporting laws. In California, there are very strict criminal laws against surreptitiously making video or audio recordings. Most states don't require all-party consent, but California does. So if I had been asked by the Center for Medical Progress, what state should I do my surreptitious recording in, I would never have said do it in California. I would say, based on what we know now, California would offer Planned Parenthood a very favorable venue.
So you teach media ethics and law, and I just wonder, where would you file these cases? The RICO case, the prior restraint case, this grand jury indictment in Texas that was supposed to go after Planned Parenthood and went after the Center for Medical Progress instead.
This really is a professor's dream for an essay question for exam, because it has everything. It has a highly charged political issue. It has a righteous group of advocates who are out to right a wrong and will use any means to do that, including deception and breaking other laws. You've got an organization that provides services, but now there's a question about whether they're breaking the law in the process of doing that. Are they culpable or are they being smeared? And what does all of this have to do with the public right to know? What I worry about is that the courts will use this as an opportunity to basically denounce what I would call legitimate news gathering practices because they're so offended by what occurred here.
So a fantastic essay question, but not multiple choice.
Not a chance.
Jane, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Jane Kirtley is professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. So legally, the general rule for undercover reporting is not to break the law. But ethically, there are guidelines. Perhaps the most important is not to cross the ethical line in such a way that it draws attention away from the reporting. In other words, don't let journalistic misconduct hijack the story. Brooke Kroeger is the author of Undercover Reporting, The Truth About Deception. She's assembled a database of nearly 200 years of undercover reporting, divided into successes, stories with big stakes and big impact, or lapses, when the reporter does cross that ethical line, thereby smothering the story and dishonoring a time-honored tradition. Here she offers some rules for doing it right.
First of all, is it a big enough, important enough subject to warrant this kind of scrutiny? One value that most organizations that would permit it would say is that it should be the journalism of last resort, and I would not say that. I would amend that to say that there's no other timely or equally effective means of presenting the material, because impact is the point. Also, did you mitigate against peripheral harm? You don't want a worker who's not sophisticated about journalistic practice to end up without a job because of what you did. You would have serious vetting up the editorial ladder, and you would have other people looking at it from outside. You would have lawyers helping you through the ethical and legal thickets, because you can see what happens. You end up with the story going elsewhere. It's no longer your story. It's all about your driver's license.
You also say that guidelines require, if not quite telling the truth, at least not lying.
Correct.
With regard to your guidelines,
yep,
not disclosing information isn't necessarily lying.
Correct.
Giving the impression that you are somebody that you're not isn't lying. Lying is just answering or filling out a form in a way that is patently untrue.
Okay, so let's try this. Some of the Nashville, Tennessean exposés of the early years, really famous reporter Nat Caldwell would use the name Nat Green, which was his middle name. Reporters who are known by a nickname might use his or her formal name that they are not known by. That's a pretty typical ruse that's acceptable.
That is acceptable.
It's pretty acceptable.
There's a great deal of stress in the journalism community, I think, over the videos from the Center for Medical Progress. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, there's a strong desire to protect the First Amendment, and many people believe that this group should have the right to disseminate their videos and then maybe pay for it later, but certainly not prior restraint. At the same time, many of these people are worried about the fallout for abortion rights. And one of these people is notably fictional. Diane Lockhart in the show The Good Wife. Now, stay with me here.
Okay.
I know you're familiar with this episode from November. It's actually based on one of the prior restraint cases around these videos. Describe Diane.
Oh, Diane is this terrific lawyer of a certain age, incredibly well-dressed, head of a firm, and generally left-wing, though married to a right-wing guy.
Yeah, she's got all the liberally approved positions. But now she has to argue a case on behalf of a group very much like the Center for Medical Progress, who've made an undercover video about fetal tissue being sold, and there's an injunction against releasing it. So she's put in this difficult position to defend abortion rights or defend First Amendment protections. We have a clip of Diane here speaking with one of her other clients, the head of a national women's group, who speaks first.
How can you do this?
Lee, if you're talking about this case, it's not about choice. It's about the First
That's
Amendment.
That's a nice, neat justification.
The pro-choice position isn't so weak that it can't stand up to the marketplace
of ideas.
This isn't
about censorship. This is about an orchestrated right-wing war on women.
Lee, I will join you in arguing against the substance of these tapes, but only after they're made public.
But that's insane. We wouldn't have to argue against them if they weren't made public.
Sound familiar?
Sure.
So what do you think about these videos from the Center for Medical Progress? Would you put them in your undercover reporting database?
Well, at this moment, they would probably fall under lapses because of the method that was employed and the way it was executed, at least if the charges of this substantial editing turn out to be correct. You know, the criteria for the database is, did you have impact? And if the impact is hijacked by your method, then you fall in the lapses.
Did you struggle with this question at all?
Oh, sure. I haven't put any of this new material mm-hmm. up, largely because there's so much legal wrangling going on now. Let's see how it plays out. I mean, it doesn't look good.
Nellie Bly.
My old friend.
She did a first, didn't she?
She actually didn't do a first. She did a second. But hers was done in a way that got the attention because of her personal narrative. It's one of the things that speaks to why I see this as a method that should not be lost. There are certain cases where it is really the way to get information out and to get action.
Could you quote anything from Nellie Bly's 1887 expose of the Blackwell's Island Lunatic Asylum, where she got in as a lunatic?
sure I can. They get the page to work for me. My teeth chattered and my lips were goose-fleshed and blue with cold. Suddenly, I got one after the other, three buckets of water over my head. Ice-cold water, too, into my eyes, my ears, my nose, and my mouth. I think I experienced the sensation of a drowning person as they dragged me, gasping, shivering, and quaking from the tub. For once, I did look insane.
Brooke, thank you very much.
You're so welcome. I hope it helps.
Brooke Kroeger is the author of Undercover Reporting, The Truth About Deception, and she also teaches journalism at New York University. Her database is at undercoverreporting.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Martha Lee Rao. We had more help from Dasha Lizitsina, Alex Friedland, and David Conrad, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And by the way, if you want to be entered to win a hat crocheted by me, you still have time to sign up for the newsletter at onthemedia.org/newsletter.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.